Hey, Heather here. Designed to empower individuals to be their best self, the Ron Kitchens Always Forward Leadership Podcast brings fresh understanding to the issues today's leaders are facing and equips them with new perspectives and resources to lead forward. Welcome to today's conversation with Ron Kitchens and Brad Lominick.
Hey, thank you for joining us for the Always Forward Leadership Podcast. I am so excited you're here. And as usual, I don't know, as usual, that sounds coarse. Hey, I'm normal. Just glad you're here, Brad.
I'm a normal guy on a normal routine with a normal schedule.
Just a normal guy.
Connected to a normal leadership podcast.
With normal pants on that you put on one leg at a time.
That's exactly right. And for all of those who are listening, thanks for being a part of the community. It continues to grow, Ron.
It does.
I don't know if it's because I've come on.
No, it is.
And all of my relatives in Oklahoma decided to ask the question, what really is a podcast?
Well, and they upgraded from their flip phones to their iPhone 7s.
Yeah.
I think the great thing about the world we live in today allows people to come in and out of lots of different cultures.
Yeah.
And curate your own life. Where I'm from a little town, Ozark, Missouri. It's not so little anymore, but it was 14 miles from the courthouse square in Ozark to the courthouse square in Springfield, Missouri. And as a kid, we never went, ever. It's too far. The movie theater was there, and it was three screens, you know, for 100,000 people in that region. And three screens was plenty because
right.
Nobody ever traveled.
Right. We went to Branson growing up for vacation. And at that point, it had a couple of hotels. It had the bumper boats.
Oh, I love the bumper boats.
It had the
Ride the Ducks.
The batting cages.
Yeah.
Ride the Ducks and Silver Dollar City.
Uh-huh.
And it was the epicenter of what I thought was the greatest place on earth. Having not made it to Disney at that point, you know, Silver Dollar City and Branson was the go-to. So if you haven't gone to Branson, people, do yourself a favor and book you a trip to Branson, Missouri.
Absolutely.
And get you some big funnel cakes.
Man.
Ride the bumper boats. And enjoy the festivities.
Yeah. So, well, we'll switch to the opposite direction to Charles Duhigg of the New York Times.
Yes, exactly.
So you had an incredible chance to talk to Charles when he was in for Catalyst University and you were backstage. So it's a little noisy in the interview. But what are we going to hear? What should we expect from this interview?
Well, we talked a lot about his most recent book, Smarter, Faster, Better. And Charles is one of those people that you can basically lob him any question and he will hit it out of the park because he's so educated. He's somebody who is constantly learning. He's a curious leader. And part of what he does at the New York Times is he's in many ways an investigative journalist. And so we talk a lot about what he's learning about culture right now. We talk a lot about what he's seeing in terms of trends. He's one of these guys that's thinking about maybe the next 5 or 10 years. And also, practically, what does he do in his own life to make sure he's maintaining an edge? He's being a learner. He's, you know, able to find things that other people may not be able to find. Because one of the things that Charles does so well is he finds these stories that always give evidence of some of the points he has. And so the stories, we start to talk about where you find in those. But any time you get a chance to sit down with a New York Times bestselling author, he also wrote The Power of Habit, which many people have read that book. I mean, it was a game changer.
Absolutely. You still can't go to an airport bookstore
without
finding it. Oh,
yeah. Still out
it.
There. The yellow cover, it stands out. So those are both of his most recent books, Power of Habit and Smarter, Faster, Better. But this is my conversation with New York Times bestselling author and writer for the New York Times, Charles
Duhigg. Pulitzer Prize winner.
Pulitzer Prize winning, yes. Charles Duhigg. All right, we're here with Charles Duhigg backstage. You may hear some doors opening and random noises, so just ignore that. We're in a hockey arena in the middle
it's
of...
It's all those elephants walking around.
Yeah, Kalamazoo. So the quality will be great. The audio background may be a little bit distracting. But Charles is an amazing journalist. Many of you have read his books, The Power of Habit, Smarter, Faster, Better. And it's fun just to jump into this conversation. You already spoke this morning.
I did.
And now we're going to sort of get to do a little bit of behind the scenes. And
excellent. That's
fantastic. You got to get to the airport soon, but we'll try to jump into as many things as we can.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So I've heard you speak at many conferences, events. You know, one of the things that's fascinating, I think, about who you are and what you do is you're a journalist who integrates in the power of story. We were just talking about this before we hit the record button, but talk about why that's so important to you as a communicator, a speaker, somebody who's trying to inspire people, that you bring the power of story into the conversation.
Absolutely. I think a huge part of it is it's just impossible not to listen to stories, right? I mean, there's something kind of interesting, I think, on when I'm listening to podcasts or when I'm reading something in the paper, literally all that they have to do is say, like, you know, once upon a time, there was. And then, like, at that point, it's like, you don't really care that much what's going to happen, but you got to find out what the ending is, right? You have to find out. If you create this sense of suspense, people are just desperate to figure out what happens next. So if you're someone who writes about ideas, as I do, and tries to report and find the most important ideas and ideas that can change people's lives, embedding it in a story, it means that you're taking that medicine and you're putting a big piece of honey around it, right? Mm. It just makes it so much easier to not only absorb that idea, but to remember that idea, because our brains are designed to remember stories much more easily than anything else.
Yeah, no, it's so good. You're a Pulitzer Prize winner. Now, I don't know many Pulitzer Prize winners, so I feel honored to feel like I know you. Where do you put your Pulitzer Prize? Is this on the mantle in the?
It actually, it's on my bookcase at home. It's under, yeah. It's actually a very small. I've won a couple of other awards that they give you these big like busts and like stuff like that. The Pulitzer Prize is like literally like a small piece of crystal, which most people, like, when they're looking at it, they don't know what it is. They totally ignore it. But I know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Is that because the Pulitzer is such an honorable thing? They think we don't have to make it that big because you know.
Yes, I think that's exactly what it is. And also they're like, we're not going to spend the money to make something big.
Right. Is this part of the Duhigg dinner parties that you have to do the tour and
I would say it's unnoticeable on purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. But that is such an honor to be in your industry, in journalism and writing for the New York Times, and to be recognized by such
it's a huge honor. And more importantly, I think my aspiration as a reporter has always been to do that quality of work. You know, one of the nice things about journalism is that, and storytelling and podcasts, is that you really do have this capacity to change the world. So, you know, we wrote this series about Apple and working conditions in Chinese factories, and like 3 million people got 100% raises in China because of one article we wrote. Wow. No, 13 million, sorry, 13 million people. And so it's like one of these things where if you find something that's true and passionate, and if you can make it beautiful, you really can change the world. And so I'm very honored to be able to be a part of that.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about your journey. I know you were schooled at places that are very reputable.
Somewhat reputable.
More than reputable.
Right. I grew up in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I left New Mexico to go to Yale. I think I was like they have to allow in like 2 New Mexico students every year. So I got lucky enough to be one of the 2. And then at Yale, I met my now wife, and she grew up abroad. And so we moved abroad to Egypt for 1.5 years. And then I went back to New Mexico to start this company. I built a company that builds medical education campuses, and decided that after a couple of years of doing that, I should probably go to business school because I didn't actually know how to run a company.
What was your major at Yale, by the way?
Intellectual history.
Which is really useless in the real world,
totally.
Right?
There's very few jobs where they say we need to hire an intellectual historian.
Yes, we're looking for that one guy.
Right. Yeah. So I had to go create my own job. And so I went to business school at Harvard. And halfway through business school, we sold the company that I had started. And so I suddenly didn't have to go back and do that anymore. Hmm. And I kind of was trying to figure out what to do with the rest of my life, and realized that what I really wanted to do is I wanted to do something that was different every single day. And the thing about business, as you know, and probably people listening know, is particularly because I'd spent some time doing real estate private equity, is that in real estate, the whole goal is to do the same thing over and over and over again, to get faster and better at one thing. And people who do that, like, they're amazing. They build buildings, they make lots of money, they do good things for America. But for me, I wanted to do something where I was doing something different every single day. Mm. And journalism offered that. It offered this opportunity to go learn and to try and answer this really interesting question, which is, how can I make people passionate? How can I make them desperate to finish the thing that I've written? Right? Storytelling is hard. It's not something that, like, you're either born with. They say natural born storyteller. That's not true. A storyteller learns how to be a storyteller, and you have to practice it, and you have to think about it, and you have to work at it. And I thought that was something that could fascinate me for the rest of my life.
So that was a significant switch, though, in terms of life calling, a sense of purpose. What was the process for you? Because so many people, even when they've been in something for 20 or 30 years, they're still looking around going, what am I supposed to do with my
right.
life?
It was definitely a struggle. It was not the type of thing where I woke up and I said, like, I'm going to be a journalist. Right. Everything's yeah. I mean, I spent probably a good, while in my second year of business school, like a good 9 or 10 months really struggling with what should I do with my life? Should I become a journalist or should I go back into business? And for me, what it came down to was, you know, I did a whole bunch of like tests and thought experiments. And for me, what it came down to was, who do I want to spend every day with, right? Do I want to spend every day with people who are in business or do I want to spend it with other journalists? And honestly, I just love journalists. Like I love, I mean, journalists are kind of like misanthropic jerks for the most part. And like, those are my people. someone who can always find something to complain about. Like yeah. that's kind of, I like those people. They're interesting. And so that was the thing that made the decision easier for me. Now, that being said, I was the lowest paid member of my graduating class for like 6 years. The summer after
from
I graduated
from Harvard Business School.
From Harvard Business School. Yeah. The summer after I graduated from HBS, I got an internship at the Washington Post and I lived in my in-laws' basement. Which is not like, and my classmates were going on to like incredibly high paying jobs. But that being said, like, I'm just not happy if I don't enjoy my work. I spend a lot of time working. Yeah. And so finding something that I love to do is really meaningful to me. And so I kind of made that investment.
I think it's important for people to hear, though, that the way that you made that decision or you pursued what you felt like was a sense of calling or purpose was by actually doing stuff.
Yeah.
So many people are numb and they're sort of paralyzed by, I'm not moving, but I need somebody to help me figure this out compared to, no, you're moving forward. You're actually driving the car.
That's exactly right. And the truth of the matter is that, like, you know, when people say follow your passion, I think that's almost terrible advice because nobody really knows what their passion is, right? Maybe some people are lucky enough that they're like, you know what I love? I love quilting. But the rest of us are like, I think I'd like this thing, yeah. But you don't really know until you try. And the truth of the matter is that oftentimes you only learn to like it by doing it because it's usually hard at first, right? Writing is really, really hard at first. It was so hard that I hired this guy to be an editor, like to read my stuff and tell me if it was good or not. So I was literally losing money on every single thing that I wrote because I would spend more getting it edited by, you know, some outside person. But the point is that when you first start trying to do something, it's very hard to figure out if you like it or not because it's just hard, right? It's hard to learn to do something new. And oftentimes you don't learn to love it until you've done it for a little bit. And then you figure out whether you enjoy it or not. And so the best thing I can say to people is, don't let that fear of being bad or of it being hard dissuade you. Like, don't wait for something that's like passionate and easy and just feels right. Cause that thing never happens. What happens is you say like, look, it seems like this is something I'm interested in. I'm going to try it for a year. I'm going to try it for 6 months. I'm going to work this thing to the bone. And then after a year, if I don't like it, then I'll walk away. But it's amazing how you can learn to love things because we usually don't know.
That's really good advice. In the business side for you, it still bubbles up. I mean, there's still things in your life now that are sort of feeding that.
Absolutely. So I write about business most part. You know, so the Smarter, Faster, Better and the Power of Habit, they're about how we change habits and how we learn and how we grow. But many of them are built around business stories, in part because, you know, business is what we all do. I mean, for many of us, we talk about business as if it's this dry, esoteric thing. Business is what most of us do every day, right? It's we read about politics. Very few of us actually run for office. But then you read about business, like you're doing that the next morning. You're managing people. You're trying to work with clients. You're trying to think about how do I make myself or my product or the world better? That's what business is. Business is, at the end of the day, human stories. And that's why I love writing about it.
Yeah. The two books, Power of Habit, Smarter, Faster, Better, are two of my favorites.
Thank you.
No, really. I mean, I remember picking up The Power of Habit whenever it came out, and it's the yellow book that just stands out. I mean, it's the yellow cover that everybody sort of recognizes.
Right.
But it was such a game changer from a leadership side. And connect the dots, because so many of the listeners to this podcast, they're CEOs, they're executive directors, they're principals, they're presidents. Is there a different message for you when it comes to habit and productivity for that level of leader, or is it all the same across the board?
I think it is a little bit different because I think that, if you're a CEO, if you're a president, if you're someone who's already accomplished, you know a lot about productivity, right? You already know a lot about creating great habits. And so I think at that point, the question becomes, if I'm so good at this, why am I so frustrated all the time
right.
by the things that escape my grasp, right? Why do I find myself coming home and instead of being able to have dinner with my family? If I'm so successful, why am I working all the time?
That's part of your story. I mean, you talk about that.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who work to become successful. And then like success is like this burden because you just are working all the time. And so I think that the shift that is really helpful is how do you take what you know and apply it more broadly, right? That's why the big idea in the Smarter, Faster, Better is that thinking more deeply has always been the killer productivity app. And it is now possible to be busy all the time and never be productive because you don't force yourself to think. You don't force yourself to take a step back and say, should I really have spent 2 hours dealing with emails or should I have written that memo that I've been putting off for 2 months that could change my entire business? So how do we take what we already know, the strengths that we have? How do we force what are known as contemplative routines or these mental habits into our life that allow us to take advantage of what we're already good at and really use that to change as opposed to simply reacting to everything that's around us?
Yeah. And for you personally, I want to know, like, what is one of those things for you? I mean, in your own personal life, the rhythm of life, being a father, being a spouse, you know, being a New York Times reporter.
One of the chapters in Smarter, Faster, Better is about this idea of building mental models, right? That basically our brain is designed to figure out what to pay attention to and what to ignore based on the stories we tell ourselves about what we're doing. And so it used to be that in the morning I would take the subway into work and I would just like deal with my emails or read the paper or something like that. Now every morning what I do is I take at least like 3 or 4 minutes and I close my eyes and I just visualize my day. And I do it in this very specific way. I force myself to think hour by hour what I want to accomplish. So what's the biggest goal I want to get done before lunch? What's the biggest goal I want to get done before 5 p.m.? What's the most important thing to do this week? And you'd be amazed at how much that clarifies and changes how you behave. Because it means when you get to your desk, instead of reacting, instead of opening up your email account or waiting for someone to knock on your door or getting pulled in all these meetings that you hadn't planned on, you have front and center in your head how you want your day to unfold. And so you might change that. You might adapt it, but at least you have a plan. And that it takes like literally 5 minutes every morning, but it is incredibly impactful. And that's kind of the point of Smarter, Faster, Better is that there's 8 chapters because they're built around these 8 sort of techniques that allow you to get control over what you're doing instead of just reacting.
Yeah, that's really good. I want to ask you too about what's top of mind right now because you're such a curious person. You're always thinking about not just a column or a story that you have to be writing, but also you're constantly sort of soaking up. So top of mind, front of mind, what seems to be the thing that's grabbing your attention.
The thing I'm trying to figure out right now is how to explain, and part of this is that I just don't actually know what the answer is, how to explain what's going on inside the country and the world right now. Mm-hmm. And I mean that not only politically, right? Like everyone's talking about politics right now because of the election, and that's part of it, but that's kind of a blip. What I really mean is something has fundamentally shifted in how life works from an economic perspective that influences a social perspective. It used to be that there was a whole set of jobs that were great jobs that literally don't even exist anymore. That means something has changed. The fact that I have an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old, you know, the way that they interact with the internet and with media and with each other, it is so radically different from how we were growing up that I need to understand what that actually means. We have lived through this period where there was a before and now we're living in the after. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't true for the previous 3 or 4 generations more, right? Not since the Industrial Revolution have we seen so much economic and social upheaval as we have in the last 25 years. And so trying to figure out how do you tell a story that captures that, that's incredibly important right now, I think. Mm. You know, if you look back to the 1970s when Tom Wolfe wrote The Right Stuff, it was really a story about how America changed during the space age, right? That we went from one type of hero to a completely different type of hero. And who our heroes are, they matter. And that same thing has happened in the last 20 years. And I don't know what the story is that captures it, but our heroes, our understanding of what is productivity, our understanding of what is success, our understanding of who ought to succeed and how we're happy, that is changing. And so trying to find some story that helps us make sense of that, that's what I'm thinking about right now.
And on the hero side, Are there heroes for you that you're inspired by on a regular basis?
There's a lot of people that I like, that I just think the world of. I mean, a lot of them are historical figures, you know. I mean, when you look back at someone like Martin Luther King Jr., you know, he was in his 20s when the Montgomery bus boycott started, right? He had this mantle of leadership thrusted onto him at an age when most of us are like trying to figure out how to dress ourselves every morning. And he was in his early 30s, I believe, when he won the Nobel Peace Prize. He is such an example of someone who managed to keep his head about him in the swirl of so much complexity that it's hard not to be inspired by that model. And I think more contemporaneously, you look at some of the leaders that are out there and you look at some of the journalists who are out there and writers, this dedication to saying something true and important and to trying to keep focused on what actually matters, it's really inspiring. And so hopefully we'll have more people like that.
Yeah. I feel like that's a preface for a book that might be coming. Maybe. And if it's not, I really want to read that book.
So maybe I would read that book too. If you find that book, let me know. Yeah. Well, maybe you'll write that book.
You need to write that book. I'll just be the one reading it and telling everybody about it. This is breaking news because I learned this early this morning. But you've got a new podcast coming out in a couple of months.
Right, in April or May. Yeah, with the New York Times. So I'm a reporter at the Times, and we've got a podcast coming out called Change Agent.
Which I'm excited about.
I am too. Hopefully that excitement is warranted, and hopefully it'll appear in the world on the timeline that we're hoping it will.
Is there a release date officially, or is it sometime in March or April?
Sometime in April or May.
Okay, April or May. Sorry, I'm speeding up.
Hopefully May.
Sometime February, sometime late January.
We're rushing right now to try and get it done.
This is my podcast you'll be hosting.
That's exactly. I'll be the host of it. And it's an attempt to, people come to us with problems and we try and find case studies from social sciences or from the business world or from any world, the religious world, to try and offer a solution. And then after we give them this advice, we tape them going out and actually running the experiment, see if the advice works. And sometimes the advice doesn't, right? Sometimes it's lousy advice, but hopefully you learn something important along the way.
So good. Well, we can't wait for it. And thank you for, one, just being an inspiring author and a wordsmith and somebody who curates great stories, for being here at Catalyst University at this event. And for those out there who haven't read your books, man, I just really want to encourage people to, not just because you're sitting here, but these are actually helpful books.
Oh, that's great to hear.
They are practical. They're filled with stories. They're filled with solutions, not just a bunch of philosophies. So thanks for continuing to push things out into the
market. Thanks for having me. And thanks for making such a great podcast. I listen all the time.
Well, this is fun. So we'll do it again soon. Thanks, Charles.
Sounds good.
That was an incredible interview with Charles. You know, I'm fascinated by his work and both the stuff he puts in his books, but he's a great read, both his columns, but I follow him on Twitter extensively because he's also a great curator of other stories. And he kind of tells you why that story or that insight's important. Did you get the same sense from him?
Yeah, definitely. And he's just a nice guy. I mean,
he really is.
Sometimes you meet these, you know, you and I have both, because of doing conferences and booking speakers and being around those environments, when you see somebody on stage, you always want, hopefully, to see the same person off the stage. And he is. He's just a normal guy that has a big platform now. We spent 20 minutes riding over from the hotel to the venue for Catalyst University, and he was peppering me with questions. And I was peppering him with questions. So it was like this old, you know, Western shoot-off of who could ask better questions. But he's just a curious guy, and he lives that out, you know. And sometimes you get around people, and they sort of feel like, hey, when I'm not on, then I'm just going to be in my own little world. But I just really like being around people who you feel like you're getting a congruent sense that the person you know from the stage is the same person that you're seeing off the stage. And this may be breaking news because I don't know if he's announced it yet. By the time this podcast comes out, it will definitely have been announced, but he's starting a new podcast.
Yes, he is.
So that's another thing to be looking forward to. If you're a podcast junkie, like I know Ron and I are, then that one will be in my rotation for sure.
Absolutely.
So, and of course, as we always do, Ron, we're giving away one of his books. So use Ron's name, @Ron Kitchens, and maybe send us a tweet, talk about what you were the most impacted by from Charles and the conversation we had together, and we will send you a copy of his book. Man, one of these days we're going to do like the ultimate book giveaway. And we're just going to maybe do like 24 books in one box.
Leadership Library.
The old Leadership Library.
Yep.
From Catalyst University and Always Forward Leadership Podcast.
Absolutely.
We'll get our people working on that.
Yeah, we have people. That's Bree.
Yeah.
Bree, you're our people.
Yeah. Bree, make that happen.
All right. Thanks for being here, Brad. And thanks to all of you. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for joining us for the Always Forward Leadership Podcast. We hope today's insights will help you develop into the leader you dream to be. To subscribe to Ron's blog or to submit a question for Ron to discuss in a future podcast, visit ronkitchens.com or tweet him at ronkitchens.